Thank
Okay,
you.
so welcome to this discussion meeting on of the hosted by the Consistent Democrats, and we're going to be talking about Trump and related topics, Biden, Netanyahu, genocide, and the threat of World War III, which I think is a very potent subject today. So just to get things going, I'll probably speak for about half an hour, maybe a bit longer, if that's all right. But anyway, US imperialism's internal contradictions and its desperation to hang on to its world hegemony has led to an immediate threat of nuclear war, I think. You know, it's as close to, if not closer, than anything that happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And the NATO expansion drive through the proxy war in Ukraine now means that Russia is being bombed by the United States and Britain with US and British controlled medium range cruise missiles, such as the Storm Shadow and the ATACMS. And I believe the British ones are actually American designed and sort of controlled anyway, ultimately. There's a French missile called Scalp, which is also in play in this situation. They're basically being fired by the personnel, fired and programmed by the personnel of those imperialist countries. You know, they're all similar long range missiles, but calling them long range is a little bit misleading. They're not really long range. They're long range compared to some of the other stuff that they've supplied so far. You know, but they can't actually reach Moscow from Ukraine. But they're a political more than a military provocation, you know, because they're not so much a military danger. But the real point is the fact is that Ukraine cannot possibly do this stuff independently of the imperialists, because imperialist military forces must program them and fire them, otherwise they won't be usable and certainly won't be accurate, you know. So, I mean, it means that there's a fig leaf that some on the left have hidden behind. The idea that this is primarily a national conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And that no longer holds water. It's been torn away. What it reveals is that this is an attack by Russia, attack on Russia by the US, by Britain and France. And it's not Ukraine that's doing it. That is a fiction, you know. It's not so much of a military threat as long as the payloads of these missiles are conventional. They won't change the course of the war, although there's always a possibility of nuclear weapons being sneaked in or some sort of misunderstanding about that or something, triggering off a major exchange. But, you know, for now, they are a conventional issue, you know. And the Russian response to them is the new Arezhnik missile, which is, I think that translates as the hazel tree, but there are other translations around to do with thunderbolts and four and things like that, you know. But it's, you know, it's a pretty powerful weapon. It can travel at Mach 10, you know, which is about 10 times the speed of sound. That's around 3 kilometers a second. And it's a multiple re-entry mid-range ballistic missile. That can be conventional or nuclear, and nothing really can touch it for speed and unpredictability. And it can have 26 up to 26 different warheads. It can hit anywhere in Europe, as far away as London, you know, which is probably the limit of its range. Maybe if it was fired from eastern Siberia or something, it could possibly just about hit the United States, but only just. It's really a European-scale mid-range missile. And it's a trump card for Russia. That's not meant to be a pun. But it underlines that Russia's military, Russia's missile and nuclear capability is actually superior to that of the West now. And the question is, will it stop the Biden administration and its cohorts and their military provocations against Russia? And that's somewhat of an open question, because it's probably less than likely. They have class-related reasons for attacking Russia, and they have a particular tactical take on that. So it's not very likely that they will stop. So, I mean, they demand their overall project is that they demand obedience by all those outside their imperialist club to what they call the rules-based order, which in fact is the Western imperialist-dominated order. So now they're musing about preemptive strikes in a conflict between Russia and any NATO state. So they're talking about that in leading NATO circles. There's one particular guy called General Boyer, the Dutch general, a military figure, who's actually the head of the NATO military committee, is talking about preemptive strikes against Russia. And that's their response to Putin's demonstration of the Erezhnik missile. I mean, this talk is from a Dutch general who's a leading NATO person in Europe, but it's obviously authorized by the US. They wouldn't say things like that if they didn't think they got American backing, I don't think, And even worse, there's now talk in Washington about giving nuclear weapons to Kiev, after all, And if that was to happen, the immediate result of that would be a Russian nuclear elimination of that regime, I suspect, As a result, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is a Trumpian member of the House of Representatives, called this an act of treason. The question is, which nukes were they talking about? It's not really clear because Ukraine used to have nukes on its territory. They were Russian ones, and they were Soviet nukes, I should say. And they were just taken all back at the collapse of the Soviet Union. So they can't really give them. The Americans do not have those missiles to give back to Ukraine. They're in the hands of Russia anyway, But it's actually hard to believe that the US would just give Russia, sorry, give Ukraine nukes of their own, to do what they want. Because American nukes in Britain are not actually under British control. They're under American control, So if they, if they did that, it would be even more brazen. It would be, it'd be similar to ATACMS and Storm Shadow, etc. But it would be the American-controlled nukes on the territory of Ukraine. Now Scott Ritter says that this is a lie, and it's been propagated by the New York Times, and its aim is to stir up more sort of tension. The thing is that setting this sort of thing up would probably take months anyway, and it would have to get through Congress, and the Republicans control both houses. So it may well be just talk. It might be a step too far for this lame duck administration, which we're now in for the next month and three quarters or whatever, But it just shows what their outlook is, that any country or any group of countries that defy them are targets, At this point, they cannot admit defeat. This is like Cuban Missile Crisis, plus plus plus. It will last at least until Biden leaves office. Now, to those who lived and were active politically in the first years of Ronald Reagan, before Gorbachev came along, this is not entirely unfamiliar territory, Though it may well be worse. But anybody remember Ronald Reagan's joke on a TV program? He says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have just signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes." And that was a joke. It was somehow aired on a radio program that he was interviewed on before he was supposed to speak. But it was obviously orchestrated. There's a guy called Richard Pipes who was a leading spokesman for the Reagan administration, a theoretician, leader of some think tank or something. He's actually the father of Daniel Pipes, who's today's counter-jihad intellectual nutcase, But he was, in the early 80s, he came out with this quote that said basically, this statement. He said, basically, the Soviet Union faces the choice of changing its communist system in the direction of the West or going to war. And that was a threat. That was not just a prediction. That was a threat from the Reagan administration. And at the same time, you had things happening in things like Soviet vessels being rammed by American military ships on the high seas. You had KAL 007, the the suicide mission that they orchestrated over a trip from towards Sakhalin Island or something. It flew over Sakhalin Island. A Korean airliner was shot down by the Russians. Sakhalin Island contains a whole range of sensitive military sort of installations. It was shot down by the Soviet Union. And they thought it was a spy plane. It behaved like a spy plane. It was a civilian airliner, but it was a stunt that they set up, and it was done to stoke hysteria, and it succeeded, you know. But these are very similar times. They were driven by a ruling class ideology, as it was then, and it was quite hysterical. Now, it's not anti-communism in the old pure form, you know. I don't think so. I think that it's actually rooted under the surface in the same thing, but it's morphed into an ethnic hatred of Russians. You know, in some ways, it's quite similar to Hitler's hatred of Jews, which was in good measure driven by an obsessive belief that Bolshevism was a Jewish creed and that Jews generally were organically subversive and revolutionary. And I think in today's world, to the imperialists, Russians are seen as organically communist inclined or subversive and disobedient to the world order, you know. And that hatred is what drives Western Russophobia or ideologically. So you see all these bans against Russian historical figures, cosmonauts, you name it, conductors, musicians of all different types or whatever, even historical authors being banned because they're Russian, you know, because it symbolizes something to do with Russia. It's an ethnic based hatred, you know. The question is why, you know. And I think not sure. Anyway, yeah, I mean, as I was saying, why is this happening? The deindustrialization of the West, I think, is what at bottom has led to the sort of decline of US power, economic and military power, you know. Whereas Russia has, to a real extent, reindustrialized, or it's arguably refused the medicine, the so-called medicine of deindustrialization that imperialism sought to force on it through Yeltsin, you know. And Putin has reversed much of Yeltsin's shock treatments from the neoliberal shock treatment that Yeltsin was responsible for from the 1990s. And thankfully, he began doing that when there was still the capacity left in the Russian economy to reverse it. And I think that's actually, in some ways, that's why Trump appears to admire Putin, you know, because he was able to do what Trump would like to do, but he cannot do so because of the class realities in the United States, which is reindustrialize America. That's part of his MAGA project, isn't it? And he made absolutely no progress in that in his first term. And I don't think he'll have much success in his second term either. I just think that's beyond the capabilities of US imperialism. But it also underlines what Biden and possibly Blink, I think it's more likely it's not Biden, it's Blinken and Sullivan and some elements of the military, I think, who are actually involved in this drive in the lame duck period, you know. But they're trying to preempt Russia. They're trying to preempt Trump on Russia and Ukraine, you know. They're trying to stitch things up to the point that Trump cannot, despite what he's actually said he wants to do, he cannot negotiate his way out of Ukraine, you know. Now, let me just talk about Trump for a bit. I mean, Trump is domestically, he's virtually a fascist, you know, as we point out in our statement, you know. But there is at least this rhetorical isolationism in his international policies. It may be rhetoric. It's not really clear, you know. But Trump's election is extremely ominous in terms of, you know, American domestic politics, and the responsibility for it lies with the Democratic Party under Biden and Harris. You know, as Trump represents extreme right-wing reaction, and though, you know, Ukraine played a major role in propelling Trump to the White House because of Basically, because of the economy, because of the surge of inflation that coursed through Western economies, including the US, as a result of sanctions, and particularly oil sanctions, against Russia. Now, Trump intends mass deportations so-called illegal migrants, maybe up to 13 million, they're thinking they will expel, using the military. And he's advocating nationalist economic policies, such as imposing tariffs on goods from Mexico and China and Canada. And now, I mean, I think the Mexican and Canada, he wants to impose a 25% tariff on goods from those countries. He wants a 10% tariff on China. I think China is a very major trading partner, and they will have problems with that. And now he's threatening BRICS, that he's threatening sanctions against everybody in BRICS, including Russia, I suppose, which is more than half of humanity, actually, is now in BRICS, either associate or full membership of BRICS. And he's what he's saying is he will impose sanctions against all these countries to stop the emergence of a BRICS currency as a rival to the dollar, which of course is part of the project of BRICS. Domestically, again, he's in favor of further stamping out of abortion rights, and possibly a federal ban, but probably not on abortion itself, but on the posting of abortion-related medications, which will make abortion qualitatively more difficult to obtain, even in states where it's legal, And he proposes to weaponize the US military for domestic attacks on political opponents, including the Democratic Party. He proposed to use terrorism laws, so-called terrorism laws, will be used to drive non-profit publishers who dissent from Zionism or dissent from US militarism in Ukraine or whatever, to drive them out of business. I mean, the law to actually permit them to do this is actually already in train in Congress, even before the new tranche of Republicans take office, which they don't do until the president takes office, of course. And of course, the left and any movements against police violence, against such things as Black Lives Matter, if it were to that movement to revive, they will come under heavy repression of some sort. And the same is true of labor struggles. Although the benefit of that, if it does happen, it will tear to pieces the illusions that some working class people have in Trump. But the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is likely to be gutted in such cases where people try to invoke it against Trump, as are labor gains. Apparently Trump's crony, Elon Musk, who boasted about his involvement in a coup in Bolivia a few years ago, he's actually filed a legal case to try and get Trump's judges, that is the Supreme Court judges, etc., to declare that the National Labor Relations Board is unconstitutional. I mean, that's the NLRB that was set up by Roosevelt in the 30s under the pressure of the historical labor upsurge in that period, and all those things are really on the agenda because Trump stacked the Supreme Court with his own far-right appointees during his first term. And for the past 4 years of the Biden administration, he's retained at that far-right supermajority on the Supreme Court. And that's how Roe versus Wade, which was the federal right to abortion, effectively de facto, not de jure, but de facto, was overturned, even though Trump was actually not in office. Biden was in office. And Biden did nothing about it. But because of this supermajority, when push came to shove, the Biden administration also failed in its bid to hold Trump criminally responsible for the attempted putsch that took place on the 6th of January 2021. And the Supreme Court conveniently ruled that Trump, as president, was immune from prosecution for that. for all official acts, you know. So the bottom line is, when the Democrats are in power, they've done nothing to deal with what Trump bequeathed them, you know, like expanding the courts, even in the first half of Biden's term, when they could have tried if they wanted to, you know. So I mean, this is fundamentally because doing something about it, in quotes, would actually require mobilizing a mass movement of the working class to crush Trump's far right movement. And the US ruling class in both parties would fear that more than they would fear fascism and a possible Trump dictatorship or semi-dictatorship. You know, they're more frightened of the masses than they are of such a thing, you know. And that's the political reality in the US. It gets obscured, you know, it's been obscured recently by the fact that, certainly for people in the knowledgeable people on the left who know what's going on, there's some obscurity about this because, in domestic terms, the Democratic Party is still a bourgeois democratic party. But it's cowardly and subservient before the Republicans, whose majority is basically now a fascist or proto-fascist in their program. But it is obscured because the Democratic Party has backed fascism in Ukraine. You know, it funds Azov. It's funding the Banderists in Ukraine. Their frontman Zelensky, who was seen in the Canadian Parliament applauding a Ukrainian SS veteran last autumn. You know, things like that, which actually really show up what these people are. You know. But at the same time, the Democrats in their domestic sort of posture and their domestic politics still adhere to constitutional politics, which is probably it's pretty clear that Trump does not, you know, that the Republican Party in the main do not. That causes a slight amount of confusion, I think. But this kind of separation is not really new, you know. It's only a modern manifestation of something that Karl Marx observed in the middle of the 19th century about British imperialism and the way it operates, the duality between the way it operates at home and the way it operates abroad. And Marx wrote this. He said, "The profound hypocrisy and inherent barbarism of bourgeois civilization lies unveiled before our eyes, moving from its home where it assumes respectable form to the colonies where it goes naked." That's from an essay called The Future Results of British Rule in India by Marx from the New York Tribune in 1853. You know, I mean, those who harbour illusions in Trump because of his oppositional posture over Ukraine ought to remember that it was under his presidency, as Scott Ritter noted, that Zelensky was groomed for the role he's playing now as Jewish camouflage for the Maidan regime, whose Nazi proclivities have become too obvious and well publicized in that period since Maidan in 2014. And Trump actually tore up the INF treaty between Reagan and Gorbachev, which was an obstacle to the use of the missiles that the West are now firing at Russia from Ukraine, as well as an obstacle to Russia's response, incidentally. And Trump's differences with the likes of Biden, when there's any substance to them on international questions, are ones of are not ones of principle. You know, they're ones of tactics. Their aim is to preserve U.S. hegemony as much as Biden's, as in the slogan of "Make America Great Again." You know, that's what it means. Yeah. So. You know, a key element of those differences is in visceral pro-Zionism, I think. I think that for some people around Trump, particularly Israel, is more important than Ukraine. You know, I think that's really the substance of it. Yeah. And part of it's in a dispute over whether Russia or China are the most important adversaries for US imperialism. If you look at some of Trump's choices for his new cabinet, his new administration, some of them are actually ultra warmongers against Russia. You know, people like Sebastian Gorka, Marco Rubio, you know, they're diehard supporters of the proxy war against against Russia over Ukraine, and they're not going to be easily shifted from that. So I don't know exactly what he plans. Yeah, but so these are some of the most virulent warmongers imaginable. You know, just as bad as anybody in the Biden administration. And there are others like Mike Waltz, who's the National Security Advisor designate, who professed to be concerned about escalation and want some sort of a deal with Putin. You know, but Waltz says at the same time, though, he says, I'm working very closely with Jake Sullivan, that is Biden's man, you know, National Security Advisor, on the transition. And does that include this escalation? I think we'll find out eventually, but he says he's working very closely with him. But what Sullivan and the bourgeois so-called deep state, that is the military, etc., are doing seems to be designed to frustrate this element of Trump's policy. And Scott Ritter actually described it as some kind of a coup. And it's certainly unprecedented for a lame duck president to behave like this, aiming to screw up his successor in quite such a blatant way. The only other person who did it was Trump. And that went beyond legality on the 6th of January 2021. Yeah, it went outside the Constitution. Its main motive was domestic. It was anti-migration. You know, it doesn't. You know, this what Biden has done doesn't break with the U.S. Constitution in the letter, but it does actually. You could argue it's an attempt to screw up the next administration, and it's against the spirit of the U.S. Constitution. But anyway, it remains to be seen what effect it will have. You know, at the outside, it could start a nuclear war, but short of that, I don't see what they can do. I mean, any policies can be modified or scrapped. You know, if it doesn't actually cause a nuclear war. I'm just going to move on a bit now to the question of the ICC's indictments against Netanyahu and Gallant, and also the Hamas leader Mohammed Daif. He's also been indicted, but he's probably dead. The Israelis claim that he's dead, but that's relatively minor. That's an index of the cowardice of the ICC, really. More to the point is the political impacts. You know, I mean, Netanyahu and Gallant are indicted for murder, for persecution, and using starvation as a weapon to commit crimes against humanity. You know, the US has condemned the ICC, and some Trumpian has actually threatened to invoke the so-called Hague Invasion Act if Netanyahu or Gallant were arrested. You know. Whereas most European countries and Canada and much of the world has actually signed it, or if not necessarily for pro-US reasons, you know. And it's going to cause problems for all of these people, you know. And this is not yet quite matured yet. The verdict of the International Court of Justice on genocide is not complete yet. You know, it's a different court, obviously. That's the one that considered the question of genocide at the end of last year, you know, and gave a provisional judgment in January, you know. But they were, in the light of this ICC warrant, in the light of all that's happened since, they'll find it very difficult to acquit Israel of genocide, you know. So it's all a bit, you know, it's all a big problem, strategic problem for the West, really. I mean, Germany says that they won't implement that warrant, but they, for their own reasons, to do with their supposed guilt over the Holocaust or whatever, you know. But they signed up to the ICC, so it's a legal minefield for them. You know, it could be challenged in court over refusing to implement it. And Macron has said something similar, you know, that he won't indict Netanyahu or won't arrest them if they come to France. But there may be other legal players in that if that ever did happen. You know, in Britain, Starmer and Cooper are trying to evade the question, as far as I can see. But the legal question is actually quite clear. You know, the British government is in the High Court now, and activists are looking for a judgment to force an arms embargo on Israel, and they may well get it. You know, that's not the half of it. There could be big problems to come for politicians who backed Israel. So these differences within US imperialism over, and within imperialism in generally about how to handle all these questions from Zionism to the war against war in Ukraine and China, etc. They're all intertwined and they're becoming more and more so. I mean, looking at what's going on now, the reason that Israel has just signed up for a ceasefire with Hezbollah, with Lebanon, is because both sides have taken major casualties in the last 14 months of war. But Israel has relatively taken more, and it's not capable of fighting on. So they've got this ceasefire, which apparently Hezbollah has not endorsed, but Lebanon has endorsed. Well, we'll see what happens to it. But the reality behind it is Israel was fought to a standstill in southern Lebanon, despite the losses that Hezbollah suffered, despite the death of Nasrallah, the pager attacks, and the destruction that which is on a obviously a less comprehensive level, but it still resembled Gaza, what they've done to some of the Lebanese towns and cities. Some of the bombings have been absolutely appalling. So the Israelis have been forced to retreat in Lebanon. So what have they done? What's happened? And I don't know. We don't really know what relationship, who's responsible for this in terms of within the US and what role the Trumpians have played. But they've reactivated their terrorist networks of pro-US and Al-Qaeda jihadists in Syria, And there's a conflict going on. It's been on for several days. There've been attacks on Aleppo, attacks on Homs, and major confrontations. And the Syrian army apparently has now got them. Has now made serious progress in clearing them out again. But what's the purpose? They're restarting the jihadist war against Assad, but it's really about trying to close off the avenues of supply to Hezbollah through Syria. Because it's impossible for the Israelis to besiege Lebanon the way they besiege Gaza. Because there's obviously geographical reasons, because Syria envelops a whole load of Lebanese border territory, and that's the way in, isn't it? That's the way in for Hezbollah's armaments and things. So they're trying to screw up Syria to turn the screw on Hezbollah, because they lost in Lebanon, But this attack, it brings Russian and Iranian forces into play, And Russian and Iranian forces have been involved in what's been going on over the last few days, And both played a major role, of course, in preventing a repeat of the destruction of Libya getting on for a decade ago now, actually. They stopped the destruction of Libya being repeated in Syria, And Iran is an ally of Russia now, of course, and it's rendered it some technological help in Ukraine with drone technology and the likes, So the logic of Zionist militarism and its various travails in this area, in this situation, it can point to a clash with Russia. And even though Trump may well be wanting to avoid that, I mean, the wisdom is, the dominant wisdom is that Trump seeks to avoid a clash with Russia, but he may be dragged into that anyway, when he takes office in January 21st, I think it is. So, I mean, there's so many contradictions that point to the strategic defeat of US hegemony. And that is what's behind all the stresses and strains and this major crisis that's going on now, that does actually pose the question of the possibility of nuclear war. As communists, we need to be providing revolutionary leadership in this situation, advocating anti-imperialist united fronts to deal with these various barbarities that are going on. We think that the problem of Zionism and its genocidal aggression against the Arab peoples need to be resolved by such an anti-imperialist united front. And we would demand that Russia and China throw their full economic and military resources into fighting the Zionist genocide and defeating Israel in what, you know, in, particularly in Gaza, in what is a life and death struggle for the Arab peoples. And we, as you know, obviously we advocate the independent mass mobilization of workers whenever it's feasible. You know, I mean, previously we've advocated a what we call a coalition of the willing, which sort of like caricatures what Bush did over Iraq in a way, you know, to intervene militarily to stop the Zionist genocide wherever it's happening, you know. And in fact, the recent Iranian retaliatory actions against Israel also underline that that's feasible. But in the end, even an anti-imperialist united front is not completely adequate, you know, because every such united front needs a consciously revolutionary working class component to make it effective and viable. You know, the only permanent road to peace, the only solution to all the problems that beset humanity in this situation, from the threat of nuclear annihilation to such disasters as the destruction of the biosphere by capitalist-induced climate change, you know, the only real answer to that is the creation of a new mass communist movement internationally, you know. So, I mean, we stand for the creation of a new world party of socialist revolution to unite all subjective communists, all consistent anti-imperialists under one banner based on free discussion of differences and but hopefully unity in action. You know, that's what we think is what we need to be propagandizing for and trying to bring into existence, such a party based on free discussion of differences, but unity in action in pursuit of an international socialist program. So, but, you know, in the end, that workers' revolution is the only road to peace, and that's as bold as it gets, you know. And I will leave it there, and I'll open it up to discussion. Thank you, comrades. Cheers. Anybody want to speak? Anybody looking to speak? Susan.
Yes, I'll weigh in a little bit. I do think that the control by the media, of the media and the narrative, means that we need, if we don't want to get skewered by the old prejudices, shall we say, yeah, of which I suppose communism and, you know, you can't talk to an American, as far as I can see, without them trotting out the same, ah, but it was all fine because we were killing communists. And you still get that for, you know, the anti-Russian. As you say, it transmogrified into what's basically nakedly an ethnic, you know, racist theology that basically regards Slavs and Chinese and other groups as inherently inferior, which in a sense is their worst enemy, because they despise these particular groups so much, they do not think that they can be beaten, which is why they are suffering, shall we say, on the military field and certainly in technology. But we need to be looking, I think, more at explaining these in terms of human rights, and particularly the anti-genocide, the immorality of imperialism, the immorality of only valuing people by how much money they're worth, and the idea that somehow it's not a problem for the profit motive to underpay people for the work they do and for the, you know, for the skills and the labor that they have, and for the lack of opportunities by which they can be contributory members of society, not because they aren't capable, but because they are held back, shall we say, by their access to education and skills and support while they gain those skills. Yeah. So if we want a workers' international, we should be emphasizing the importance of the equality of humanity. One of the things I think I would say that I would have liked to have heard more about is Trump has basically declared war on Africa, and he's going to help countries like Britain and France to re-establish their colonial and neo-colonial empires, their financial hold, stranglehold, if you prefer, on Africa, while Trump gets on with taking out, as he sees it, South America, not just Brazil, but also Venezuela and other countries where there are resources and oil to do that. So this is us framing it in terms of against neo-colonialism and trying to explain to people that our domination, or at least the square mile and Washington Wall Street's control of finance, condemn people to debt slavery. And everybody who's ever been thrown out of accommodation, you know, the rents that landlords charge that is so much higher than our access to wages, the mortgages that are so much higher, and the fact that our wages have not kept pace with the price of housing, the way in which the building firms control where and when they build houses and of what sort. Yeah, that we are continually priced out of the market, that it's about uniting those people and making people understand that we are only, you know, 1 month's salary. And in a world which is increasingly where you can be blacklisted for what you tweet, that we are far more vulnerable to, you know, authoritarian control. Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else want to speak? If not, I'll just briefly come back on that. I mean, I agree with a lot of what you say. I think the only quibble I have is using the term human rights, because I think that's slightly a term that can have many, many meanings, and it can have meanings that are quite deceptive, I think. You know, I mean, in terms of the way it's used by imperialism, etc. My point is it's about the rights of working class people, and it's the rights of the oppressed, really, and of humanity in general, in a sense, but the overwhelmingly oppressed layers of humanity, which are the majority, of course. You know, I think there's a slightly different way of posing it, but yes, I think a lot of the points you make are very valid. You know, and we do have to produce more material and on lots of different questions of abuses and inequalities and symptoms of the decay of capitalism. Yeah, so I mean, the more the better, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and if others have got more contributions to add, that's very welcome. You know, and I think we should actually, you know, we should try to be as inclusive as possible in that regard. You know, Simon wants to speak. Sorry, yeah.
Yes, so just interested in how you envisage the anti-imperialist United Front, because you're saying pressure basically should be put on China and Russia, and they should be quite central to this anti-imperialist United Front. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in how this relates to political interventions at a grassroots level. Now, I've just come back from the Czech Republic, which is a very good example of a kind of dialogue, a national dialogue that's going on in very chauvinistic terms on either side. You bump into Russophobia all the time. I do a lesson with a Czech lawyer, and he says, well, you know, the Russians cannot handle democracy. They don't know how to deal with it. They don't understand it. they're part of this Asiatic despotism. There is legislation being proposed at the moment to strip Russian Czechs of the option of a dual citizenship. You know, so even at a legislative level, we're getting discrimination clearly against Russians. There is quite a substantial anti-war sentiment and mobilization, but it is very much behind nationalist forces, including Tommy Okamaro's SPD, which is basically a fascist organization. Babish looks set to win the 2025 general election, and he's been saying that the present neoliberal government are dreaming of war with Russia. Now, I thought it was quite interesting because Alex Kalinikos put a picture of one of these anti-war demonstrations. He didn't seem to make the link with the fact that all the Czech flags actually indicated an ideology that was not necessarily progressively anti-war. It was tinged with a nasty anti-Ukrainian kind of sentiment, which you also get in the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. I've been looking at feeds today about Ukrainians are responsible for the crime, all the Ukrainian refugees, where they're in concentrated numbers in various towns, it goes up. Now, on a practical level, the Communist Party of Czech and Moravia, they've actually intervened on the side of these demonstrations. They've participated, they've leafleted, even though the predominant forces are kind of pro-Orban, pro-Fico in Slovakia, pro-Babiš, etc. So to concretize the question, do you think the Communist Party are right to try and orientate and relate to this movement despite these very reactionary kind of contents, ideological contents to it, even though in the final analysis, it is a movement that seeks to stop the war in Ukraine?
I'll just come back on that again. I don't want to monopolize the discussion, but I actually think they are right, more or less. It doesn't mean that they're right in every detail. They may well get important things wrong, but I think the idea of orienting towards, in some ways you have to orient towards people who have illusions in Trump in the United States, insofar as they are tending to support him for progressive reasons, even if they're completely wrong about what he's likely to be. And the same in Germany with the AfD. You know, I don't know as much about the Czech Republic today as I do about those countries, you know, because it's more difficult to get information on that, and it's a less prominent subject perhaps. And the Czech Republic is possible. I've been there once, but that's just pure happenstance, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it sounds like they're doing more or less the right thing, but they may have flaws in their propaganda because they are a Stalinist-derived organisation. I'd be interested to know how big the Czech Communist Party is today, actually. And it's interesting that they still call themselves a Communist Party, because a lot of the ex-CPs in Eastern Europe don't call themselves that. But in the early days of the after the Second World War, the Czech Communist Party was absolutely enormous, wasn't it? It was the biggest in Eastern Europe relative to the population, if I remember rightly. And that was partly to do with what happened in the 30s and the perceived betrayal of Czechoslovakia in the Munich Agreement and things like this, you know. But I think there's a difference between Vico and Orban, actually. I think Vico is a social democrat, or at least his background is social democratic, whereas Orban is a right-wing pro-Zionist nationalist who just happens to have a pro-Russian element as well, you know. But we have to orient towards those people. We have to orient towards the people who support them for the right reasons, who then may well be completely wrong about their nature, you know. But it has to be done carefully, I think, you know. And that's a learning process, actually, because you ask about the anti-imperialist United Front and how practical it is. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's partly a question of you have to set a strategic perspective and try to find ways to implement it. And a lot of this is it's virgin territory. Adventuring into new fields that has never been really done before. The early Communist International tried to do things like this, but it was cut short, really, by the degeneration of the revolution. It never really properly matured. But I think some of the things that they advocated in the early theses on the Eastern question and things like this are actually very valid. You have to find ways, and there will be a certain amount of what's the word, making it as you go along, or at least trying things out to see what works, you know, in doing so. I think the Sparts have been having some quite interesting discussions about this and how you implement an anti-imperialist united front as well, you know, in places like Mexico and Argentina and whatever, you know. But I think it applies everywhere. You know, you have to relate to those forces who are opposing the enemy, the main enemy, but you have to at the same time not be seen to implicitly endorse the terrible flaws that some of them have got, you know. If there's a right-wing mobilisation against a war that we oppose, then it's complex, isn't it? You know, but we have to find ways of tapping into that and separating out what's correct from what's really very, very badly wrong. And that, maybe I'm talking abstractly as well, but I'm trying to sort of, you know, put some parameters on what you have to try and do. But the actual working of it out is a detailed question. That's how I would see it, anyway. Yeah. If that answers your point, I'm not sure. Cheers, Susan.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the other sort of elephant in the room is the religious oppression,
mm-hmm.
and the way in which, certainly in Ukraine, you know, in many ways, the left were caught on the hop with, we weren't told very much about anti-trade unionism, anti-democracy, the banning of political opposition parties, the ethno-fascism that was the, you know, burning of Roma camps and other things in Ukraine. There was a little bit of reporting about it, but once it became, oh, the Russians have invaded, suddenly all of that melted. And, you know, there has been an absolute conspiracy to stop anyone pointing out the, you know, very long origins of Banderism, if you like, yeah, neo-Nazism in Ukraine, which has been welcomed by the sort of whitewashing of Azov as far right. But if you look at Europe, everybody who wants to be out of the EU is somehow a far right or a far left political party, no matter what they do, because it's about, you can always join the EU, but what you mustn't do is vote to join or become independent. And you can see that in Georgia, can't you, at the moment? Yeah. But I think that we're not looking at the extent to which the Vatican is heavily involved in a lot of this. You know, this is not just about hearts and minds. This is also about souls, as far as certain theological groups are lined up. And I was very impressed by Haim's speech yesterday, or the one that was shown this morning on Crispin Flintoff's show, about the misuse of religion and very dedicated people to colour and change the way that we are, you know, we are being led blindly to support very extremist religious cultist theologies without people really understanding the full import of it. Zionism is the easy one, but there are others, and they are incredibly dangerous for how they will dominate our education system in the future. Did you know, see no sign of that in Czech? I had a friend who was Polish who was just horrified by the extent to which, after Lech Walesa came in, that the Roman Catholic Church practically took over. The Virgin Mary became the Queen of Poland.
Yeah,
and things like that.
Just to answer that quickly, it's very different in the Czech Republic. It's 80% atheist, but that did, but it doesn't mean that a kind of reactionary discourse did not arise. It's an incredibly pro-Zionist consensus there at the moment, for example. So it is very right-wing, reactionary. Havel was kind of mystical in a sense, this kind of weird sub-Jungian nationalism that he promoted, but no, not specifically the Catholic Church, for reasons of historical difference with Poland.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, but you could see it in Serbia too, couldn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, for me, one of the things that's important about Russia and China is we're sold in the West that it's somehow both atheist and intolerant, but at the same time, it's fairly obvious that certainly for Russia and China, they are far more tolerant of religious beliefs and ethnicities in their own countries than we are here. But we are always selling ourselves as being, you know, the bastions of democracy and multiculturalism, which we're just not. Simon?
Anybody else?
Sorry, you're muted.
I've got nothing else to add to that. I see your point.
Mm-hmm. Who else wants to speak?
I wanted to ask about the Trump thing stopping the war in Ukraine. Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you. You come in now, Mark, and then is Tony or John?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about Trump with the war in Ukraine and bearing in mind the conflict with Israel, him being a Zionist. Do you think he will put a stop to the wars? And further to what Susan was just saying about China and Russia, I remember going to, we went to see a friend in Shanghai. I remember going to church on Easter Sunday in Shanghai. It's a lot more a tolerant society than people think it is, and it's full of... It's a mixture of old and new cultures. So, yeah, I would agree with that. And I remember the Soviet Union as well was quite kind of, there was a lot of different kinds of churches and a lot of religions there. But, yeah, my main question was about Trump stopping these wars and why so many of the left are following it, saying that, well, if he does that, then that's brilliant. We love Trump. Anyway, that's...
I'll let Tony come in. I wasn't aware Tony was here, but Tony can speak. Of course, come here. Tony.
Just a quick question about, you know, you made the point about, I don't know if I got that properly, about Trump allowing Russia, Britain and France to regain colonial control over Africa.
Yeah.
And, you know, to do with the... I don't know exactly what it entails, but there is an aspect to that with the Chagos Islands, because part of the rationale for Trump supposedly objecting to the Chagos Islands is because it will allow China in. But China's already sewn up a lot of the mineral deals with African countries. So maybe you could say something about that.
Cool. Well, just on that, that wasn't my point. I think it was Susan who made that point, but it's a valid point, I think. They are not happy about the loss of control of North Africa, particularly the North African countries around the Sahel, Niger, and Burkina Faso, and a bunch of other countries, Mali, etc., where the French have effectively been kicked out. And the Americans have been kicked out as well, insofar as they had a presence, you know. By these, some of these regimes that overthrew supposedly democratic, but in fact puppet regimes that were run remotely by, mainly by France, have been kicked out, you know. And regimes that are perhaps more military in their configuration, but are more independently and nationalist minded, who really don't want an imperialist presence in dominating their countries have come to power. I think the price of uranium that was supplied by Niger to France, it's now they're now having to pay the full market rate for it, whereas they're paying about $1 a I can't remember exactly the kilo or something like that of uranium, some token amount, and now they're having to pay the full market rate, which is about 100 times greater. And the French nuclear industry is suffering because they used to be able to rob Niger, which I think is one of the most prolific producers of uranium in Africa. They used to be able to just rob them and pay a token amount. And now they're having to pay the full price. So that's one example. And I believe Trump has made remarks about this, although I can't remember the full details. I think Susan has probably taken more note of it than I have. But it is about that change in the particularly in the North African area, where there have been a bunch of puppet regimes have been overthrown in the last year or so. You know. I mean, we commented on that in our big sort of statement on the post counter revolution Cold War, you know, and what's behind all these conflicts. And it's about the loss of U.S. hegemony leads to the loss of hegemony in other places, loss of authority of the U.S.'s allies in some of their ex-colonial or neo-colonial. Shadow empires, or what's left of their empires, you know. It's certainly true of France, you know. I think that's what Susan was talking about. What was your other question, Tony?
Oh, no, that's it.
That was it, yeah. Okay.
Well, just that aspect.
Oh, the other question was from Mark about Ukraine. Do I think Trump will actually do anything about Ukraine? I think he might, because I think there is tactical difference about which is most important. Whether Russia is more important or whether China is more important, there are divisions in the American ruling class about whether also backing Israel in its various conflicts with its neighbours and its attempts to dominate the Middle East. Israel is a slightly more complex question because Israel has its own power base in the United States, and it can make it can, if you don't do as you, you know, if bourgeois politicians don't do what the Israelis want, they can be punished by the Zionist lobby. So, and Trump, of course, is very close to the Zionist lobby. Many say he's an Israeli agent. He was actually funded in his election campaign by Likud for Miriam Adelson, the widow of Sheldon Adelson. Gave him $100 million for his election campaign, you know. So there is that factor in American politics, the power of the Zionist lobby, which is a bit more complex question. But there are also tactical differences. They want to split Russia from China. That's what Trump wants to do, whereas Biden just was gung-ho, go for Russia. You know, I think that's a tactical difference. And that is not necessarily on the level of the Zionist lobby. You know, it interacts with both. You know, it's complex, and there are differences in the American bourgeoisie about which, because they're losing hegemony, they can't do everything, because they're not as powerful as they used to be. And this whole thing about being able to fight two wars at once. Well, are they really capable of fighting two wars at once now? You know, maybe they have to focus on one. And when there are major conflicts in the world, that they're trying to preserve their world power, but it's declining. And as I said, part of the reason is deindustrialization makes it difficult. You know, they don't produce all the weaponry they used to produce. It's been so much industry has been outsourced elsewhere. You know, it's all very complex. So they are losing hegemony. You know.
I agree. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to speak?
I also think one of the places that I'm afraid the West is not really taking much notice of is India. And where India wants to be seen as number four. And it should be, but it's another massively multi-ethnic multicultural, you know, long civilization, very, very important. But at the same time, there is always the issue with the 90% Hindu as opposed, you know, religious majority, in the same way that, if you like, China had to come to terms with its own 90% Han Chinese ethnicity, which is going to be difficult, and it's long-running war with Pakistan. But going back to Africa, it's the support of the Sahel terrorists to continually harass African countries against the idea of becoming more self-determined and to have internal investment. And they resent the fact that China has been investing in building things, whereas America just sells them the twin dishonesty of, we'll protect you from, you know, we'll sell you the weaponry and we'll protect you from the terrorists that we're funding in order to keep your prices low and you to have no control over your own resources. So, you know, the fundamental dishonesty of, you know, the American business plan has been exposed, whether it's in Nord Stream with the way that the US attacks its own supposed allies and shamelessly steals its technological and industrial skills and people, while at the same time, you know, as far as I could see, Trump plan A was, we won't fund Ukraine anymore. If we walk away, then France and Germany and Britain will have to fund the Ukraine war while we get on with, you know, beating China. Yes, I'm afraid I'd agree there, Diane. But the thing is, Modi is being offered the chance to be part of the multipolar world, which means that whatever he, for his own politics at home, has the opportunity to be a major player with respect in the world, which is what BRICS is offering. Whereas I think the West is a feudal state in which a bunch of ruling elites think they're born to rule. And they have, you know, they might let the occasional person, you know, Lammy's a case in point, where they think that just, you know, and Rishi Sunak was another, they think that they're ever going to be tolerated. But the truth is, you know, the supremacists amongst the ruling class look down on them and despise them. You can see how quickly they fall the minute that they're no longer useful.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tony Blair, no matter how unpopular he's been, he still swanned around the world for 10 years as, you know, Middle East envoy, collecting money and God knows what all at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Modi is a fascist, that is for sure. He's a Hindu to a fascist, you know, a very unpleasant character, and, you know, but yeah, I mean,
yes.
How long, but, you know, he was not the driving force of BRICS, really. BRICS existed before he came to power, you know, and he's managed to ride along with it.
Yep. He was very flattered by Biden and then still realized that, I suspect, America is a waning empire, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's a bit like Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro did not pull out of BRICS when he was president of Brazil, you know, even though he was a Trumpian ally, a fascist himself, although his regime was probably not fascist, but his politics were fascist, you know. He was an elected leader, as is Modi, but his underlying politics are fascist, yes.
But they're still talking sanctions. Trump is, you know, Trump seems to think sanctions are going to work. I mean, if sanctions didn't work on Russia, and they're certainly not going to work on China,
on the whole BRICS,
find more sanctions are going to do, you know?
Well, I think that's true. I think sanctions will backfire. Trump's threat of sanctions against the whole of BRICS, if they bloody well if they come up with this currency idea, which they have, they are talking about it. They haven't actually created it yet, but so if you create a currency that's rival to the dollar, we will sanction you. Well, that actually might help it, because it will, you know, sanctions against Ukraine, against Russia over Ukraine, have not actually hurt Russia. They've actually hurt the people carrying out the sanctions, and have actually bolstered Russia by forcing it to diversify some of its economic, you know, activities. They've actually helped it. So who knows? It might have a totally counterproductive outcome if Trump tries something like that. It might be suicidal, actually, for the United States economically, you know.
It's a bit like buying a bag of peanuts and it says on the back, warning, may contain nuts. Well, yeah, that's what I bought them for.
But again, it's the, by sanctioning countries, their oligarchs, their plutocrats, their billionaires are now forced to invest in their own country.
Yeah.
Whereas it's the, you know, what's killing the British economy, as far as I can see, in more than anything else, is, you know, we own half the tax havens in the world, and our billionaires are busy outsourcing everything and investing nothing in the actual, in actually Britain.
Mm, that's true. Who else wants to speak? Anybody else? Shall we? Otherwise, we'll think about. I mean, I'm not got a great deal more to. I mean, a very good discussion, actually. But if nobody's got anything else that particularly want to add to it, we might as well stop the recording and go on to any other business if that's what people want. Yeah. But does anybody want anything else?
I was going to ask about BRICS. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing that so many of them. That so many dodgy countries are all getting together, and is it going to change their behaviour by working with other countries? Is it going to make it better? Is it going to be better than NATO, in other words?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think so?
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes, I'm really sure, because I think it has given. You know, listening to Russia and China, listening to people coming back from Russia, particularly on Pepe Gonzalez, isn't it Pepe Gonzalez? No.
I know you mean Pepe Escobar.
Yes, yeah. I know. I keep thinking Pepe Escobar is absolutely brilliant on talking about, you know, the various BRICS summits, because they don't just happen once, you know, when Putin is doing them. I mean, they happen every single month of every year and have been doing so for the last 10 or 13 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, the thousands of people who are working on making this system work is part of why Russia has, you know, it didn't crumble, why the ruble is not rubble, why they are capable of, you know, producing more than 10 times what every other NATO country, and I'm sorry, but that does include America, are capable of producing. As they said, do you know about the THAAD missile system?
No.
There are, you know, it's sort of the next one up from the Patriot, but there are only 9 THAAD systems, and each, you know, array of 36 missiles costs over $1 billion just to launch. They don't think there's more than a 25% chance that they would ever even hit one of the multiple systems from that Oreshkov system. And it costs billions, yes, to actually launch. You know, they have basically, you know, they thought they were being clever. They made their warfare, their missiles and their weapons so damn expensive that nobody would be able to rival them, because America spends 10 times more than, you know, more than the next 10 countries put together. But the truth is, small, you know, it's been shown that money is not enough, that it is not possible to outproduce countries where they are making their own. You know, I mean, you can see it in Hamas, where most of their weapons are actually the 40% of unexploded munitions that are being dropped on Palestine at the moment. They recycle them and send them back and use them to blow up, you know, the Merkava tanks and the rest of it. They're fighting Israel with the weapons that, you know, the dud weapons that America is sending Israel. And, you know, the same was true of the Challenger tanks that were donated. Most of them don't work. F-35 is the only plane where 50% of them can never be, you know, have to be in the shop being looked after by mechanics while only half of them can fly. It's, you know, it's called the flying piano for a reason. No? And, you know, we have, what is it, 3 aircraft carriers, and they don't, you know, they don't sail straight. It's all about willy waving. And the Oreshnik, the reason I say lightning strike is because the hazel tree, which is what I think the correct translation is because the hazel tree is sacred to Thor, and it's, you know, Thor's hammer of thunder and lightning, and it's the hazel tree is to do with the fact that it doesn't get hit by lightning. Whereas obviously the Oreshnik is, if you look at it landing, it looks like lightning strikes. It is so fast. And that speed is 10 to 20, I think, is the maximum you know, the Mark 20 would be the maximum speed that they think it could go. But Mark 10 is sort of, is how fast it was going. And it will literally atomize what it hits at that speed. So it does not need to be nuclear missiles, but it could be if it had to be. And isn't it Bauer, not, what did you call the you're muted, Ian.
Yeah, so it's Bauer, yes.
Yeah, it's Bauer.
Bauer, the Dutch guy.
And Rutte, who's the new EU chief, is equally stupid when it comes to threatening Russia.
Paul, followed by Diana, yeah?
Yeah, to add to Mark's point about the bridge, I somewhat disagree with you, and I don't think it would necessarily mean it's better. I think it very much depends on how the working class in those each individual country react and whether they continue to work with each other across those countries. You know, as Mark once said, nothing is inevitable. I can't remember the exact quote, but it is dependent on the material forces available at the time. You can't just rely on the leaders of the individual countries or individual programs that have been set up. In the end, it will depend on the international working class to make connections, realise what's going on, and it's up to us all, really. You can't just assume that because we've got a body that's going to come along with all invent a new currency and it's not as simple as that. Obviously, countries are going to vary in different ways from each other, so it does depend. I take probably a more orthodox Kropke's line on this, and to say, or I think it's to say that it does depend on the working class of all of those individual countries. Thanks.
Diana.
Yeah.
Countries, I mean, the European countries, Britain, particularly Britain and the US, are particularly bad, and the US is worst of all. If you don't provide people with the means to live and support themselves, you don't provide people with useful education, particularly technical, scientific education. You haven't got healthy people. You haven't got educated, skilled people. You can't produce anything. And if you've got companies that are theoretically meant to be producing stuff, but they're totally profit driven, they're not going to produce stuff that's of quality and that works and is useful. They're after producing profits, and they're not willing to pay for people to survive and have a proper education and do a proper job. So that means, we need to be there, ready for the collapse, to replace it with something positive. But that collapse will come, whatever people do.
Yeah. I think we should remember, though, that one of the founding principles of BRICS is no sanctions. That if you are a member of the BRICS, you know, an actual signed up member of BRICS, that you do not sanction other countries. It's interesting because China was certainly selling component parts to both Russia and Ukraine. The West were upset because they were selling component parts to both Russia and Ukraine. And obviously, while the West do that routinely with other wars, they haven't done it. So they've solved the problem by just simply saying they're not going to be selling drones, I think, from next year, which is another reason why, Zelensky was rather upset. Because obviously Ukraine depends very much on those. And Yushmak, the big industrial complex that was making drones and repairing tanks and all sorts of other things deep underground, is what was hit by the Oreshnik missile on the 25th of November?
Yeah,
and they're still talking about, they don't know where they're going to hit next. But, Russia has stepped in to help Syria. And China has stepped in to help countries which were being bullied by America, particularly the sanctions and the other things, to, you know, buy them out of their debt. That doesn't stop the ruling class from immediately coming in and saying, oh, well, if we've been bought out of our debt, we can get ourselves involved in yet more deals. But, you know, in the same way that... Israel made the deal that it did with Lebanon, but Hezbollah and Hamas have not agreed to that ceasefire, and they will not if the settlers and Israel continue to bomb them. You know, but there's nothing in our UK press about us leading attacks on Yemen, which we've done, I gather. There's been a new couple of invasions using US troops, UK troops. Did anyone know? I've only just come across a couple of things. You know, what is it? Is it Sir Richard Moore, MI6 boss, is on record saying about how many, how much sabotage training we're doing, you know, that when these new round of 18-year-olds that Zelensky is going to conscript, that they will be trained in France and Britain to do sabotage acts in Ukraine if they have to do a ceasefire, and we're going to send UK troops to keep the peace, by which they mean armed Ukrainians. Of course Putin's not going to accept it, they're doing everything they can to ensure that Russia has to take this, because this comes back to, this is going to be the new Afghanistan, And what will it do? It'll be 20 years of America being involved in Europe in more direct occupations. Well, the truth is, America's got military bases all over Europe and dozens in the UK. You know, we're all occupied countries. We've just got so used to it, we don't notice. But as you said, all the nuclear weapons are going to be fired by the US. They're not going to be fired by anyone here. Our generals can sit there and talk about it, but it's not going to happen until Trump decides to press the red button. And he'll fight his nuclear war in Europe. He won't be fighting it in America.
Just on that, the only country in Europe that still has an independent nuclear deterrent is France. You know, yeah. And they've always had that and always insisted on it. So they've got different missile systems. Although they're intelligence, they're very similar in some ways. They are actually their own, and they do decide what to do with them. But the British ones are not, really. They're basically American remote-controlled stuff, you know. Just on Mark's point about what was likely to happen with BRICS, you know, will BRICS force countries to behave better, countries that are basically not imperialist countries? Well, I don't think it necessarily will. And this is a point we made in our statement on the question of the post-counter-revolution Cold War, is that if this situation does come into existence where US imperialism loses hegemony and, effectively the West loses its whole domination to a bunch of... an alliance of ex-workers states and current workers states in a couple of cases, and semi-colonial countries cause the, this is the situation we're now in, cause the US to lose its hegemony. There is no alternative to the US amongst the imperialist world. There's no Germany coming up on Britain or whatever, trying to become dominant. What you've got instead is this situation where there'll be no dominant imperialism. And what will happen in that situation? Well, what's likely to happen, I think, is that a new imperialism will emerge, probably not including Russia and China, because they have a peculiar structural hangover from the decades when they were workers' states. But there are other countries you could imagine, like India or Indonesia or... who knows, you know, that could actually crystallise once the imperialist monopoly is broken, you could see the emergence of new imperialist countries out of that layer, you know, because it's basically imperialism was a self-perpetuating club, wasn't it? And it would stamp on other people. And there's nothing capitalism does develop organically and spontaneously into imperialism. The problem with Russia and China is they're not fully capitalist, but some of these other countries involved are, you know, and they could actually develop into new imperialisms. The only new imperialism that's developed so far since the Second World War is Israel, but that was transplanted, you know. But other things could emerge, you know, it's always possible, because imperialism was a self-perpetuating club. And if that's a broken, someone else could actually force their way into the same position through organic growth. That's entirely possible. I mean, that's a theoretical possibility, I think, but it's a realistic possibility.
I think Ukraine was being groomed for that position in Europe, and you look at how that's moved there. But I think you've missed out Japan, who definitely sees itself as coming up as
Japan was always imperialist. That's the point.
Yes, I know, but they do see themselves as taking over the imperialist position in in Asia, if Taiwan kicks off, and that will be an unfortunate situation, won't it?
Well, I think Japan is an American client, and it's been an American since World War
II. Well, they'll all be American clients, won't they?
Well, not necessarily. You don't know what could, if the US loses hegemony, what may happen to some of these, either to the, you just don't know. I mean, there are possibilities, aren't there? That's all you can say. You know, some of the imperialist powers that are American clients now might rediscover some balls if the US were to really take a nosedive in terms of its power, you know. On the other hand, there could be the emergence of new imperialist powers because the monopoly of the West has been broken. Who knows? You know. It's an open question, but we know that capitalism organically tends towards imperialism. Although the world is divided into oppressor and oppressed countries, nevertheless, that is what capitalism tends towards. You know, that doesn't mean all capitalist countries are imperialist. That's a mechanical caricature of that position. But that is Lenin's view: is that imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism. I think that's still true. You know, and it's a bit more complex than that. You know. Sorry, am I rabbiting on?
No.
Paul had his hand up.
Paul, yeah? Sorry, yeah, Paul, did you have a hand up? You just wanted to say something, yeah.
That was merely to agree with what you were saying about the nature of capitalism. Once somebody no longer has the hegemony, as it were, or the hegemony, whichever pronunciation you use, you know, the nature of capitalism is to want to expand and expand. And so if somebody else loses, their current hegemony, somebody else is going to take their place.
Which is
why we're always going to come back to the point that what we ultimately need is for the global working class to destroy capitalism. So, which is why I think a lot of comrades, not just in our group, but in other conscious groups as well, possibly romanticise the whole concept of the BRICS a bit too much. Initially, as it's been developed, it's clearly a good thing in the terms of it could destroy the American hegemony, and it is doing that, as far as I can say. However, that is not enough in itself. It's merely a vehicle to allow working class forces in each of those individual countries to sort of rise up and inadvertently become a tool to actually destroy capitalism. You know, Marx always talked about, I can't remember the quote, but while capitalism creates the tools to create more capital, at the same time, it's also creating the tools for its own destruction. Mm-hmm. You'll know the quote I mean here, but I don't know it exactly. And I think even today that is still very much true. So just because BRICS have been formed and they're in the process of forming a new currency and so on, you can't just rely on that. There will always be one country in there that wants to outdo the current developing countries that are working their way up the industrial chain. Unfortunately, it's in the nature of capitalism to want to expand and expand. And that's the only thing capitalism does do. It doesn't necessarily create more things that are useful. It's not to do with that. It's just to expand power and that sort of thing. So I think it's a mistake to, I'm not saying necessarily that people are seeing the BRICS as a panacea, but I just think there's a bit more to it than that. And as Ian and other comrades have alluded to in the past, the BRICS have got some countries in it which have very dodgy ruling classes who are not socialist in the slightest. And we should constantly be aware of that. Thanks.
I mean, I think that's very true. I think the, you know, that BRICS is playing a progressive role at the moment, but it doesn't mean it will always do that. All sorts of transformations are possible, and we have to be aware of that, that capitalism never stands still, and things do develop into their opposites in some situations, you know. And that's just the nature of capitalism, you know. Sorry,
but
Paul.
You don't own the future. The more that you try and proof something, the worse it gets. So the reality is you have to, it's a matter of checks and balances to persuade people that the future that they want to see is one in which we all participate. Sorry, Paul, I've interrupted when you put your hand up.
Ian, when you were saying about how things get reorganized, that was one of the reasons why I was so depressed when I read Joseph Chinaro's Unraveling Capitalism. I'm sure he didn't mean it to be...
What was that? I think you mentioned this before. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah. Joseph Chinaro was one of the students of Chris Harmon.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book called Unraveling Capitalism. And I'm sure he didn't mean it to sound depressing, but what he's basically about is how capitalism is always finding new ways to reorganize itself, to keep itself going as a force. And I think, unfortunately, I think we are going to find that in the BRICS countries. And, I think it's incredibly naive to think that just because one hegemony is out the way, that we're not going to get another form of hegemony. Used to be Britain, now it's America, and it can easily be someone else, you know. So until we destroy capitalism as a system, this is always going to be an ongoing thing. And even when you do destroy capitalism as a system, we couldn't then assume it's a done deal. There's always going to be counter forces against it. There's always been, hasn't there, Ian?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, there hasn't. And that's why I really disagree with you. But it's okay. You know, we're allowed to have different opinions, certainly about what the future may bring.
Well, I'm sure we'll explore this stuff more in future discussions.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that we need to discuss today on this question, or does anybody want to say anything else that's relevant to the point? If not, should we stop the recording because it's quarter to six and. It's been quite a long and fruitful discussion, I think. Yeah, John wants to speak.
Just briefly to say, it's very difficult to discuss the epoch you're living in because there's so many imponderables and unknowns that it's difficult to tell. So all this. The role of the BRICS and the role of, you know, we can look at it, but it's there's always imponderable factors that come up and change the whole discussion, you know, and that's inevitably going to happen, and I agree, you know, like there is going to be a new order that emerges from this current period, but what that order will look like is you know probably very different to what we think.
Yeah. Just on that, I mean, Alexander Dugin is the theorist of the multipolar world, isn't he? But I think he's a utopian, and it's a utopian, somewhat strange vision actually. Different chunks of civilizations rubbing against each other and collaborating, and it's a utopian sort of vision of the future. I think that the future is not determined by things like that. It's determined by class struggle in the end, and that's the, you know, whatever we analyze things, it has to be in terms of class in the end. I know there's a lot of complexity. There are relations between oppressed and oppressor nations. There are ways that imperialism can go through qualitative shifts, and I think we are going through a qualitative shift at the moment, which is why things are so dangerous. But yeah, it's about class in the end, you know. But the way that is expressed is it can be very complex. You know, I think there's a lot of people on the left who see it in a very sterile and formulaic manner. I think we have to be a bit more, you know, sort of aware of the possibilities anyway, you know. Should we leave it there? Should we stop the recording now? And we'll meet again in 2 weeks. We continue our discussion of Trotsky's The Revolution Betrayed, I think. Chapter 9 is the next chapter, which I haven't really properly looked at yet. But I'll come up with a proposal, yeah? If that's all right with comrades, yeah? For the next discussion. And I'll switch the recording off now anyway, yeah?